want to thank Jennifer for organizing this symposium and giving me an opportunity to talk about this project that's been funded by several agencies, and it includes people from several different departments on campus and some graduate students. What I'm going to do in my talk today is go through the rationale for looking at on-farm habitat and give you the reason why organic growers need habitat, some of the specifics why, and then go over an effort we've been through looking at implementing beneficial insect habitat and other habitat on organic farms on a large scale, and finish up with a new study that we've got looking at this habitat for multiple ecological services. Well, if you look at the more or less traditional organic farm in North Carolina, which is kind of typical of a lot of organic farming operations in the Southeast, you have a relatively small operation, probably 10 acres or less typically, a lot of crop diversity, tremendous crop diversity on that farm, and the farm is surrounded by a lot of natural habitat typically, and it's often somewhat isolated from large agricultural areas. But from a beneficial insect standpoint, this is really, really good habitat. About 12 years ago, we did a survey with a student, a colleague of mine in crop science, Mike Linker, and we looked at beneficial organisms, parasitism, predation on organic farms in the Piedmont area, and we found tremendous levels of parasitism and predation relative to a more conventional farming operations. And we concluded that really what was going on here is you have few broad-spectrum, highly toxic pesticides, you know, the obvious things, really high plant diversity, crop diversity, and that promotes a lot of diversity in beneficial organisms that creates a more stable community and enhances biological control. And you also have source populations for beneficials, a lot of natural habitat around these farms. Well, that's the traditional way organic crops have been grown, but the organic market is growing tremendously, and we've had a response by growers, particularly in our main crop producing area in eastern North Carolina, and this is probably a growing trend across the country, where we get these large monocultures now over organic crops being grown. And this is one grower here that has 300 acres of organic sweet potatoes. He provides Gerber with all their organic sweet potatoes. We worked with this guy for 3 years, and we were on his farm one day visiting with him about results, and he got a call from one of his distributors that wanted 2 million pounds of organic squash. He said, no problem. And then, you know, the next day he went ahead and planted all that acreage in organic squash. Unbelievably big operation. And this is typically now what we're looking at. In eastern North Carolina, big fields look like conventional agriculture. And what they're running into now is a decline in this natural habitat that supports beneficial insects, not only predators and parasitoids, but pollinators as well, and vertebrates and other things. So one of the things they need right now, particularly in these big eastern farms, is good beneficial insect habitat. And I want to briefly run through what makes good beneficial insect habitat. One is to attract beneficials, and that's often where people stop. But the next step is you've got to help these beneficials somehow, increase their health, reproduction, and then of course you've got to get them to move from the habitat to the crop, and once they're there, attack the pests in that crop of interest. You can't have scaleated wasps that attack grubs, enhance their populations. They're not going to help a tomato crop, for example. And then the beneficials, your ultimate aim is to economically reduce pest numbers. So a lot of growers that we encounter will plant a strip of flowers, and that's kind of the anecdotal way of implementing beneficial insect habitat. Well, that does provide value often feeding sites for beneficials in the flowers, getting floral or extra floral resources or honeydew, things like that. But you've also got to provide a variety of other things for beneficials. Oviposition sites, you've got to have alternate host populations that they can build up on maybe and then move into the crop you're interested in. Nesting sites, here's a crambird wasp pulling a stink bug down into a burrow on one of our farms. Mating sites, often insects will require some kind of topographical feature like a hilltop or a roadway or a forest margin to gather on, and that's where they focus their mating attention. Overwintering sites, here's an example from New Zealand of a beetle bank for carabid beetles. Build up high numbers of carabid beetles in the wintertime so they can move into the crop and feed on aphid pests, the cereal crop. Dispersal corridors. So these are all things that are important to us for beneficial insect habitat, but how do you tell a grower with a farm like this that they need to completely alter the way they're doing business and put all these things in for beneficial insects? They don't want to do it. They can't do it in a lot of cases. And so how do you convince them to include beneficial insect habitat in their thinking? Well, Fiedler, Landis, and Ratten, in one of a few really good reviews of conservation biocontrol that came out this year, talked about stacked ecosystem services. And that is trying to design habitats that meet a variety of needs, not only beneficial insects, but things like recreational needs and pollinator needs, variety of water quality needs, a variety of ecosystem services that you could design habitat around. And they gave an example of vineyards down in New Zealand where they planted ground covers that were beneficial to the flowers, help some parasitic insects increase their populations. They're also attractive flowers to look at. And so they incorporated that into vineyard tours, kind of an ecological walking tour. Well, in the U.S., in crops like this, how can you implement habitat in a large scale? Growers cannot do this simply to enhance beneficial insect habitat. So one way to do this is to look at the land use patterns. And we did that in North Carolina. And most of North Carolina is forest land. Then there's developed land. Then you get cropland and pasture land that make up about 7-8 million acres. And then about 131,000 acres of that agricultural land is CRP land. That means programs where the government pays people to do a variety of things, including improving wildlife habitat. And we have started work a few years back with some folks in the wildlife, North Carolina Wildlife Resources Commission and the NRCS, working with them to see if we could take advantage of an existing program that was being implemented, the CP33. That's the upland bird habitat buffer, basically quail habitat, and see if we could work with them to use or modify their habitat implementation to put up beneficial insect habitat. This is a program that covers about 11,000 acres in North Carolina. That doesn't sound like much, but if you look at a 30-foot buffer along a crop field, and see how many miles that is, that's getting into the thousands of miles of field borders. That's a lot of potential habitat that we could be impacting. So we started working with them and tried to figure out what kind of habitat to use. And we started by looking at commercial mixes of insectary plants that have been looked at for years for value for beneficial insects. And thought about what are the key characters we want to see in some of this habitat. Well, number one, you want it to be easily established. Number two, competitive with weeds. Perennial or reseeds itself, get overlap blooming so you have one or more cultivars available all the time. Inexpensive, does not attract pest insects, and I'll talk about that a little bit later. Attracts, supports a wide variety of beneficial insects, and the most important that I'm going to deal with at the end of the talk is results in economic reduction in crop pest numbers. Well, if you look at some of these habitat mixes that are, or at least were available back when we did this study, they sound good on paper, and they have a lot of plants in there that have been shown to support or feed some types of beneficial insects. But there's a few other things to consider. One of them is agronomic characteristics. And we had a student, Mary Croner, look at planting date, plant mixes, and rates of different habitat types to see if there was a way to incorporate these habitats onto a farm without hand weeding. And a lot of these plants had been shown in the past to require hand weeding. And this slide from the first part of her study kind of sums it up. I'm going to show what happens for one of these varieties. When you start out, you plant these things in the fall according to the supplier's directions, and then let them go. If you don't hand weed them, what happens is by the end of the summer, you get a whole pile of weeds and no habitat plants. And that's the same for every one of these commercial mixes. And it may be maybe a unique characteristic to the Southeast because we have intense weed pressure down there. And so plants have to be really, really competitive to work in the Southeast. And this was typical of her study. We did a lot of rate work and planting date work and found that really these habitats couldn't be grown agronomically without being hand weeded. Another student that we had, Lisa Forehand, one of her projects was looking at planting. We transplanted habitat from these mixes around tomato plots. And we did paired plots where we put the habitat plants like fennel and a whole bunch of other plants. This particular mix in this slide had 18 different habitat plants. And we transplanted these plants around the perimeter. We kept them hand weeded for 2 years. And looked at parasitism and predation in those plots compared with plots that we planted with millet and then kept mowed to about 1 foot as our control. And two of the things we looked at were egg parasitism by Manduca hornworms and Helicoverpizea, tomato fruit worms. And here's a shot of 2 years of data looking at sampling egg parasitism in the control, the black line, and the treatment line. What you can see is over both seasons, there was no significant effect from planting that habitat around those tomato plots. So egg parasitism was not affected by planting that habitat. If you look at larval parasitism, so that was a really tiny parasitic wasp. This is a bigger braconid wasp. We found the same thing. If you look at parasitism over 2 years with the control and the treatment being the habitat plants, again, no effect in both years on parasitism in these tomato plots. We found the same thing for predation. We found no effect at all on beneficial insects in these tomato plots. And we picked tomatoes because that's a crop that's grown on just about every single organic farm in North Carolina. And that's pretty common throughout the Southeast. Okay, so what kind of habitat to use? If we wanted to use a habitat in these CRP lands, we have to have all those characteristics I talked about earlier. One type of habitat that's early successional and is going to work well, I think, is a prairie type habitat. And in North Carolina, and it's not atypical for a variety of states in the Southeast, there was a lot of prairie habitat before European settlers moved in, either caused by lightning strikes or Native Americans lighting fires. And here's an example of an endemic prairie plant, Schweitzer's sunflower, that's native to North Carolina prairies. Well, the wildlife folks in a variety of different agencies in North Carolina and other southeastern states plant native warp season grasses for wildlife habitat management. So that's already been used a lot. And we also have the advantage with Prairie Habitats of having a huge body of literature from people who have restored prairie habitats for decades in the Midwest and have figured out techniques for restoring these habitats, taking old agricultural fields and returning them to prairie habitat. So these techniques have been worked out for decades, fairly well known, and we adopted those for the Southeast. We also know from work like Doug Landis's up in Michigan that a variety of insects, beneficial insects, do feed in these prairie plants. But what plants do you pick? I mean, there's hundreds and hundreds of prairie plants that you have to choose from. And some are better than others in terms of providing resources to beneficial insects. Well, how do you pick them? We decided to select a relatively small group of plants based on a characteristics that were going to satisfy a variety of needs. First, we picked grasses that we knew our wildlife folks are already planting. And they're planting them because quail love to nest at the base of these plants. They're great habitat plants. The other thing is these grasses are really helpful for management. I'll talk about that a little bit later in my talk. As far as flowering plants, we chose this group of plants for a variety of reasons. They're extremely competitive with weeds, they're easily established, they're commercially available, and they're available in ecotypes that are state specific. We can get North Carolina ecotypes of these plants that are readily available, and that prevents people from being upset about introducing non-local genotypes. And there are some growers who can't get that picky. So all of these plants have been shown to help or provide value to beneficial insects. Here's a slide showing different compositions of plants. This is a portion of a study we did looking at micro wasps. These are tiny parasitic wasps ranging all the way from mimerids that attack insect eggs up to the small braconid wasps. I'm running out of time, so I'm going to go through this a little quicker. We also looked at the bigger predatory wasps, bees, pollinators, native pollinators, butterflies, comparing those with these fallow plots that are typically put out for CP33 habitat. Typically in North Carolina, the way quail habitat is created is to mark out an area and just leave it alone. And whatever weeds grow up in there, the quail folks have found out that's great instant habitat. But from the standpoint of beneficial insects, it's not that great. Those fallow habitats provide no value for beneficial insects in the crops next door. Now these habitats, you can see the increase. This is over an entire season average. Huge increases in numbers of bees and butterflies and predatory wasps. That's within the plots. And I'm going to talk about what happens in the crop next door a little bit later. Well, how do you establish these on a bigger scale? We worked with the NRC over a two-year period. They gave us a grant to look at this, and we figured out, modified the prairie restoration techniques to look at planting, and basically you till, field cultivate, and then come in with a broadcast application of seeds. It could be something as simple as a handheld earthway spreader or a large piece of equipment, depending on what size of area you're planting, and then follow that with a cultipacker so you get good soil seed contact, and that's all you need. And then you let it go, and during that first season, you mow it. Whenever it gets to be about a foot and a half tall, you mow it down to about 6 inches, and you repeat that through the season. And you can see here a little strip that got missed. They're already flowering. That's in the first year of establishment. Well, in the second year, these plants really get going. They put down a good root system the first year, and the second year they'll bloom all the way from the beginning of the season. This is in April to September, bloom all season long, and tremendously competitive with weeds. How do you manage them over the long term? Something that's kind of scary to a lot of people who work in agriculture. It's fire, and this is a really common practice with wildlife habitat management. It can get kind of frightening, particularly in the plots that have a lot of grass, and people don't like this. But we have programs in North Carolina, I'm sure it's the same throughout the South and maybe around the country, to certify people in fire management. And so you can take a North Carolina Forest Service course to get certified in fire management, and you can get help from North Carolina Wildlife Resources Commission biologists to conduct controlled burns of this habitat. What I want you to look at, though, is a lot of people think, okay, this has been destroyed. This is what the plot looked like, this one plot, and this is typical of all these plots back in March when we burned it. But when you come back a month later, and these plants are growing like crazy. They thrive on fire, and that also reduces weed populations. So this kind of management is great for establishing and maintaining these habitats that provide multiple services. And we've this year got the NRCS to come up with a job sheet for growers, organic growers. This allows organic growers now to participate in CRP programs to enhance their beetle, quail, and butterfly populations and bee populations. The next thing we need to look at is a project that we've got going now down at the Center for Environmental Farming Systems in North Carolina on a 110-acre unit called the Organic Research Unit. And we've been given the entire unit to plant border habitats around. We divided that unit up into nine crop fields, and we're putting habitat around all those fields. We're looking at three different crops over a three-year period, and we're looking at a variety of different habitats, including the classic CP33 habitat. This is fallow cropland. This is what a plot will look like after a season if you don't do anything to it. North Carolina, tons and tons of weeds. And so we don't mow that. We mow the prairie type habitats and the classic field border habitat, the kind of ryegrass habitat. And we're looking at a variety of different things in this study. We're looking at pest management services, including insect parasitoids and predators, as well as weed seed predators. You may have seen talks earlier today showing that in more stable habitats, you can encourage carabid beetles like this and other weed seed predators. We're looking at pollination services from native bees and butterflies, and that could also be considered a conservation practice, the monarch butterfly there. Milkweeds are one of the plants we include in these plots, and we get tremendous populations of monarchs in those plots. We're also looking at recreational services. So Chris Moorman from Forestry is our wildlife extension specialist, and he's worked with quail management for a number of years and has had graduate students looking at that. He and a student are going to look at the value of these different habitats as quail for quail habitat, including something I'm looking forward to. He's planning to imprint quail chicks and walk them through these plots and see what they eat and see what type of habitat provides the best food for quail chicks. And also he'll be mist netting early successional songbirds. And Chris Rebert Horton is looking at the weed seed predation aspect of this. And we have three graduate students already working on this project. So before I finish up, I want to re-acknowledge that funding for that project came from USDA CRES, the Integrated Organic Program, and we did get funding for that long-term establishment project through NRCS and some of the earlier work from NCDA. So I don't know if there's time for questions or not. Okay, if not, thank you.